Hello, ramblers and gamblers. Josh Rosenthal here. Thanks for rating, subscribing, reviewing IG at Rambling and Gambling, and the email ramblingandgamblingpodcast@gmail.com. Have to say, I had a lovely little gambling weekend. Bet a ton of NBA, the Spence fight, a little UFC, and as we're going to talk about later on this very pod, the USFL, which was actually really, really kind of surprisingly fun. We've got Josh Ingles from Covers to talk USFL with us. I'm going to make him play a game we are calling USFL Player or Sitting Member of Congress. First up, though, we're going to talk about an effort to get the Department of Justice to crack down on illegal gambling. Joining me for that one, the Senior Vice President of Government Relations at the American Gaming Association. Here he is, Chris Silkey. Chris, thanks so much for coming on, man. It's a pleasure to have you on the Rambling and Gambling podcast.
Josh, I'm excited to be with you.
All right, before we get to the business at hand, right off the top, I want to make sure listeners know what the American Gaming Association is. I would say you guys are the national trade group that represents the gaming industry. So that would include, just to name a few, casinos like MGM or Wynn and tribal operators, and also companies like FanDuel and DraftKings. And I know there are others too. Is that pretty much right? How's my summation?
That's right. We're one of many of the alphabet soups of trade associations within the DC area, albeit one on the more fun side of things for sure.
For sure. Well, speaking of alphabet soup, let's talk about this letter sent last week to Attorney General Merrick Garland and the DOJ. You guys asked the Department of Justice to crack down on what the AGA calls, quote, pervasive illegal gambling taking place across our great nation. You specifically name websites like Bovada, MyBookie, and BetOnline. And in the letter, AGA President and CEO Bill Miller writes, quote, while the challenge of illegal gambling is not new, the brazen and coordinated manner in which it occurs has elevated this problem to a level that requires significant federal attention. Chris, take it from there. Why do you believe the feds need to get involved?
Yeah, well, the feds have been involved in illegal gambling for decades now. And of course, the gambling industry has really evolved from being, you know, mostly run by mobsters to now 44 states having some form of legal gambling. We acknowledge in the letter that DOJ has a lot of really important enforcement priorities, like keeping us all safe and prosecuting violent crime. But in today's day and age, with the internet, and certainly with now legal sports betting taking place in 33 states in the District of Columbia, these websites that are pervasive are more out there. They're using targeted advertising, more accessible than ever before. And I think there's a lot of public policy concerns and certainly economic concerns from our end, having invested heavily in a lot of these jurisdictions to stand up legal sports betting. And so, we're calling on DOJ to prioritize enforcement against some of the worst offenders that are out there that are readily accessible to everyone in all 50 states, regardless of the legality of sports betting. And we think that they can take some action. We recognize that there are some challenges around going after websites that are based offshore. But short of a conviction, we still think that tagging these entities as bad actors and taking some kind of legal steps against them will have both benefits in terms of educating consumers, but also allowing us to work within the ecosystem to really educate other businesses to make sure that they're not supporting these entities.
Essentially, you guys are saying, hey, the businesses that we represent, they're doing it the right way. They're playing by the rules. These other guys are not, and that gives them, I imagine you would say, a slew of unfair advantages. Is that accurate?
Precisely. Yeah. They don't pay federal tax. They don't pay state taxes. In many of the jurisdictions that our members operate, they're paying initial licensing fees in the millions and certainly are taxed in several jurisdictions at the state level you know, 30%, 50%, 51% in New York. That makes it difficult to operate your legitimate business. And I think the gaming industry is rightfully heavily regulated because people are putting up their hard-earned money with the chance to win money. But they're certainly, you want to make sure that that everything in that environment is safe, that the games that are offered, that the platforms that are accessible are being tested, that there's rigorous background checks being going on, that there are mechanisms to provide resolution to customer disputes. And so we don't argue with any of the regulation that's been placed on us. It just makes it very difficult to compete when you have those that are operating outside the system that don't have the same costs or commitments to responsibility and other things.
We're recording this podcast Tuesday, April 19th. So it's been a little bit less than a week since the AGA sent the letter to the DOJ. Have you guys gotten any kind of response yet?
We've not gotten any from the DOJ entity other than acknowledgement that they did receive the letter. But we've talked to some of our, it's not like we haven't spoken to the DOJ or spoken to different units. The FBI has a unit that's focused on integrity in sports and gaming. We've had a lot of really fruitful discussions with them over the years. For some time, they put out a public service announcement back in the fall to try to warn against consumers engaging with some of these offshore websites and encouraging them to go through legal channels. And we've gotten some, I think, good initial feedback from them in terms of this hopefully will lead to a process where if the department decides to put more priority on going after these, this will empower some of those who have already been kind of in the trenches working on these issues. And so I think we're hopeful and optimistic, and certainly you know, we'll rely on our friends up on Capitol Hill who this issue is relevant to, have legal gaming and sports betting in their states to try to coerce the department into putting a little bit more attention behind this priority.
In the letter, you guys write that PASPA basically allowed this illegal gambling market to thrive in the U.S., PASPA being the Professional Amateur Sports Protection Act, which prevented legal gambling in the vast majority of the U.S. until it was overturned by the Supreme Court in 2018. Are you, Chris, surprised that illegal gambling has continued to be as prevalent as it is post-PASPA, or is this what you guys were kind of expecting?
I think we expected that there would be a transition period. I think, you know, based on our research, we know from the consumer side that when there are legal options available, that people prefer to use those legal options for some of the reasons that I mentioned in terms of knowing that their money is going to be safe, that their winnings are going to be paid out, that these are regulated entities that aren't just going to disappear overnight, that they're not going to steal their identity or their credit card information. So we know that there's a lot of attraction on the legal market side. Now, there's certainly price sensitivity when it comes to some bettors, and we talked about some of the competitive advantages that the offshores have that does create some impediment to transitioning people. But I think we're sort of also in a space where to the uneducated, maybe masses who haven't been following this closely, they know that sports betting maybe is legal in their state, but they don't necessarily know which providers are legal and which are illegal. And so we found it kind of interesting that when we, while 75% of people say it's important only to bet through legal channels, there are still, you know, about 50% of people who are going through offshore and become surprised after the fact to learn that they're betting through illegal channels. So I think there's an educational gap. There's an enforcement gap, because certainly when you type in sports betting through a web browser and some of these sites pop up as the top search results, there are certainly challenges on many fronts that are going to take some time to confront. And I think legalization is a big piece of that, because if you don't have an alternative channel for people to go through, it makes it hard to dissuade them from, if they really truly want to bet on sports, seeking some alternative route. But I think we're going to get there. I think it's just going to take some time, and we have been incredibly successful on the legalization front, as I mentioned, with 33 states plus the district now having authorized that in just 3 short years, which is frankly unprecedented when you look at the state landscape and how hard it is to get anything passed, and the fact that sports betting has been a topic of conversation in almost every state capital across the country, I think is shocking of itself. But it's going to take some time as this marketplace matures, and we want to make sure that we're pushing on all of the right fronts, both in terms of legalization, but also in terms of making sure that we don't have one hand tied behind our back by having to compete with these large illegal, frankly, criminal entities.
You just mentioned a little bit of the blowback that's come from this letter. I'm sure you've seen it, especially online, especially from the professional sports betting community. And I want to give you a chance to respond to some of those concerns. I actually thought that journalist Jeff Edelstein did a nice job summing it up in an article that was published yesterday on sportshandle.com. It included tweets and comments that were, to varying degrees critical of the AGA's positioning, including from some well-known guys who we've had on this podcast, Dave Purnham, Spanky, Captain Jack, all mentioned in there. And Edelstein described the timeline. Well, actually, he called the whole thing a classic snake eating its own tail situation, his words. And here's how he broke that down, the timeline that kind of supports that point in his mind. He says, quote, "Offshore sports books are illegal, but they're the only game in town. So savvy online sports bettors flock to them. American lawmakers create legal sports books and savvy bettors flock to them. Legal sports books start limiting savvy bettors and oftentimes offer worse odds. Savvy bettors go back to offshore sports books." As you know, these are two incredibly common complaints about the legal books. Why am I being limited to betting $20 a pop just because I'm winning? And also, why can't you give me a minus 110 line on a total? Chris, what's your response to those concerns?
Well, look, from a personal perspective, I'm not unsympathetic when it comes to places where there are no legal channels. And I would say a lot of the sort of logistics around what our member companies offer in certain jurisdictions are driven by the statutory and regulatory frameworks that are set up that may place limits on the amount wagered. Certainly, we talked about some of the overhead costs that go into running a sports book operation, which at times can skew the odds and make it easier for those who are not subject to the same kind of regulatory burdens and costs to offer more favorable terms. But I work with our companies every day. They're trying to give America and American sports bettors the best product that they are able to while running a profitable business. And so I think the answer to these things is not to allow an illegal entity to kind of set the benchmark for what sports betting should be. It's to try to change public policy to improve the legal market, and whether that's just simply offering accessibility. We're certainly with those who are detractors on that, and giving places where there's no current legal sports betting the opportunity for those channels to exist. And then, changing ridiculous tax rates. And I think there will be a recalibration in a lot of these jurisdictions, because I think there's frankly a gap in terms of understanding at the public policy level of how sports betting operates. I think people see these really large handle numbers in the billions and say, oh, well, this is going to be cha-ching, a cash cow for the state. And it certainly can raise some amount of money, but it's very sensitive to tax rates. And when they're overly high, it makes it difficult for our operators to offer the kind of competitive odds, compelling products, innovate in the space in a way that we would like to in order to meet consumer demands and needs.
Yeah, we had John Martin on a couple weeks ago. John is the director of Maryland Lottery and Gaming. And he said, I'm paraphrasing here, so this is an oversimplification. This is not John's words. But essentially, he was saying, hey, our hands are tied to some extent because the lawmakers set the rule. So we can only work with what they give us. And I think that's a little bit of what you're trying to get into here.
Indeed. Yeah. I mean, if the proposition is you're either going to have no sports betting or you're going to have it by these rules, I think by and large, people have taken that we'll stick our foot in the door and let's continue to try to improve the system so that, you know, we're making money, we're offering an exciting, compelling product, and our customers are happy.
Is there a world in which the American Gaming Association would support some sort of basically reasonable limits for everybody? So no matter how much better X is winning, he can still bet at least, let's say, $500. He doesn't have to worry about being limited to only being able to get down, you know, $2.64 a bet.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, by and large, our view on this, I will mention, you know, responsible gaming is an important thread, I think, that runs through this discussion, and one that we've tried to be very front-footed in getting out ahead of. And I think a lot of the kind of public policy decisions have been driven rightly or wrongly in terms of betting limitations around perceived impact on responsible gaming. And they don't always hit the mark. And so, you know, being responsible may be different for somebody that makes $40,000 a year versus somebody who has multiple millions. I think, you know, our view is we ought to have an informed discussion about that to make sure that we aren't artificially setting limits that are going to, again, feed back into the making us less competitive with a widely available offshore market where there are not going to be any limits or any and not just in limitations in terms of amounts wagered, but, you know, some states, much to our chagrin, have decided that they're going to put in place. And I hate to mention DC so early in the conversation, but they're going to put into place some very complex systems that are going to be unuser friendly and are going to provide limited competitive choices for people. And so I think all of those kind of feed into the discussion and conversation about how we can better meet consumer demands.
So let's do the DC talk then. And actually, and just real quick, just to be clear, when I talk about limiting, I mean people who, you know, have been allowed to bet $1,000, $5,000, but then when they win enough of those bets, then they are limited. So, you know, the responsible gaming is an incredibly important topic. I'm going to bring it up later in this conversation. I just wanted to be clear what I was talking about there. It's okay, this specific type of limiting that I'm referencing.
The sharps, the people who win all the time.
That's exactly right.
Keep the hot streak rolling.
That's right. And I'm not one of them at all, not even close. I'm as square as they come. I'm very clear about it on this podcast.
Nor am I.
I am not limited, but that is like when this letter dropped, those are the people that you hear the most complaints from. Like, hey, I'm going offshore because I was doing it legally. I was doing it with the companies that AGA represents, but they limited me and now I can't bet. So, you know, what am I going to do? My hands are tied. That's their perspective. Before we move on to DC, do you want to hit on that?
I think that there's probably a very small universe of those people that are exceeding the kind of bet limits or placing large wagers that our member companies wouldn't accept. So I'm not saying it doesn't exist. Certainly it does exist, as you've heard from some universe of these people, but I would imagine it's fairly small for most of us. It sounds like for you and for me as well. Sports betting is a fun thing, and we're placing, you know, reasonably sized wagers that are going to be accepted, probably losing more than we win, and so the sports books are happy to take our money at every turn in the process.
That's yes, they will let me bet absolutely as much as I want anytime, Chris. Although actually, before we get to DC, because I do want to just finish up on this part of the conversation, that some of the stuff right now with, like, I guess what I'm trying to say is, a person like me, I only bet legally. I do not bet illegally. However, I could see why a person like me, who's a square bettor and does not get limited, doesn't have to worry about getting limited, may still go the illegal route because, for instance, I'm talking to you from my basement right now. Saturday night, I was here watching a UFC fight with a buddy of mine on the couch. That buddy does have an account with one of these websites. And the only way that he could bet on this fight live in the moment was using one of them, because I live in Maryland. There is currently no mobile betting. And therefore, if you want to bet on what you're watching on TV in that moment from your couch, there's only one way to do it. And it's an illegal option. As some of that changes, for instance, mobile betting is coming to Maryland. Do you think that this problem, to an extent, not overall, but to an extent, starts to solve itself a little bit?
I do. And I think we've already seen some evidence in that in some of the more mature markets where, notwithstanding some of the customer confusion that continues to exist that I noted earlier, but you see that search results for illegal sites are down. The amount of money that it's being bet through the legal market is going up, and presumably the amount that's going through the illegal channels is going down, because, as I mentioned, I think that a big driver of this is people want to bet through safer legal channels that provide them some comfort that their money is going to get paid out to them, that there's going to be dispute resolutions, et cetera. So I think, again, legalization is an offering accessibility through mobile is a big part of solving this. But I think that our view is the other part of solving this is making sure that the illegal actors are not right alongside us in the grocery aisle, you know? So I do.
Last one of these, and then we're going to talk DC. If you were a gambling man, what do you think the odds are that the DOJ actually takes real concrete action against, you know, MyBookie, BetOnline, these types of sites?
Well, gambling man, I would say, again, we recognize kind of the landscape that they have a lot of important enforcement priorities. But I think that we are going to be actively involved in not only pushing them directly, but making this an issue up on Capitol Hill and getting some support from lawmakers up there who fund the department every year. I think that there's no real excuse for them not to take some kind of action against these websites. I know that traditionally, law enforcement really only wants to bring cases that they can bring to a close. But as I mentioned earlier, I think even the action of charging some of these and indicting some of these operations can have some positive impact and effect from our standpoint.
Kind of send a message to everybody.
Indeed.
Real quick, because I don't want to keep you for too much longer here, Chris. DC, gambling, sports betting versus Maryland, Virginia, big topic of conversation among my listeners. I know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, look, we've seen a lot of activity in the sports betting space, as I mentioned, and I think, DC is sort of the poster child of what not to do, and it's frustrating to see how it's all unfolded. I think that the whole premise that caused them to, or that they used to rationalize moving so quickly, which was, let's get out in front of Maryland and Virginia and we'll get a first mover advantage. And that dictated the kind of, no bid contract. I think all of that has proven to be kind of a faulty foundation for what they did. And so my hope is that it's really only a matter of time before they see the light and see the other sports books that are not run by the DC lottery that are limited in terms of their reach in the mobile space, and see how well that they've done and say, this is not working, and let's change course, let's open up the marketplace here, make it more competitive, offer reduce the liability of the government, who lost money last year on sports betting, and in the process I think bring our citizens a better framework in which to enjoy this activity, because clearly I haven't heard one positive review of the Gambet app. The fact that it was down during the Super Bowl just made me chuckle, because of course it was. It's just so predictable. But I think it's sad, but I'm also optimistic that, you know, we're closer to them not being able to continue to kind of play this shell game that they've been playing, and say, things will get better. We're on our way to improvement, because if you look outside of the DC area, sports betting has become wildly successful almost everywhere that it's been offered. And the fact that it's kind of fallen on its face in DC is certainly an outlier.
Presumably the American Gaming Association is encouraging them to make some changes behind the scenes, I would assume.
We encouraged them at the outset. In fact, I testified before the council when they were talking about doing the no bid contract, and we cautioned them against the road that they were going down. It's made it difficult. I can imagine. I live in Virginia, and so I'm happy in my basement on the weekends when I want to put a little action on something. But it's got to be frustrating to be a DC resident and know that you can go to the Caesars Sportsbook or the MGM Sportsbook and place bets on site, but your mobile app only works within two blocks of those facilities. And then when you're at home, unless you're fortunate enough to live close enough to one of those things to be within the two block radius, to have Gambet as your only alternative. So I've heard from a lot of people about this, and you got to feel like there's some reason for hope that they're going to see the light at some point.
Before I let you go, Chris, anything else you want our listeners to know about the American Gaming Association? Well, we've been talking, primarily about the one specific issue, as well as the DC thing just now. I know the AGA does a lot more, and you guys have a game plan, campaign, a ton of other stuff. Take it wherever you want to go.
Yeah, no, I think I appreciate you raising have a game plan, and we are working with organizations both within DC, but also national leagues and teams throughout the country, because I think one of the real sports betting has kind of evolved quickly, and certainly the leagues, while the aforementioned PASPA law, they were the ones who were the big proponents when that was first enacted, and in fact took it all the way to the Supreme Court and lost. To their credit, I think that they've been great partners since, and have evolved their thinking and understand now that that sports betting can be something that's fun and complementary to what they do, but at the same time there's a lot of responsibility that goes into it from everybody from within the ecosystem, both on the gaming side but also on the league side. And so I think we're really excited about the partnerships that we've grown on Have a Game Plan, really set, I think, a good trajectory for a sustainable, safe, legal sports betting market that everybody can enjoy.
Chris Silkey, American Gaming Association, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Josh. I'll try not to be a snake eating my tail in the balance of the day. That's a good one. I'm going to have to use that at some point. Thanks, Josh. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris. Joining me now to talk a little USFL betting analyst for Covers, Josh Ingles. Thanks for coming on, man.
What's up, Josh? Thanks for having me. Week one is in the books, and week two lines are out. I know not everybody's jumping at the bit, but there's definitely some money to be made in the USFL.
I got to tell you, Josh, I went back and forth on whether I wanted to book a USFL interview for this podcast, but then I watched last weekend. I loved betting it. I loved it. I blindly bet against Jeff Fisher, who's the coach of the Michigan Panthers. It was just like old times. As I saw you tweet, his team went punt, punt, fumble, punt, fumble, interception in the first half. Yeah. They were down 17-0 at that point. I won a couple bucks. It wasn't even close to NFL football, but it was fun. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, the content of it is actually really good. Like, the video quality is great. Fox has put a lot of money into this. It was on NBC, FS1, USA, and Peacock. And there's some really interesting things. The quality on field isn't fantastic, and that has a lot to do with the teams were just picked 3 weeks ago. But in saying that, you get to hear play calling. So if you like football, there are some cool aspects of the USFL that are probably only going to get better as the season progresses.
Yeah, I agree with you. A couple things in case listeners didn't tune in. All of these USFL games are being played in Birmingham, Alabama. That goes for the Birmingham Stallions. It also goes for the Tampa Bay Bandits. Coaches include Fisher, former Chiefs head coach, Todd Haley. Skip Holtz is a coach. He's the son of Lou Holtz. The best known player is probably Paxton Lynch, I think, who was a first rounder for the Broncos in 2016, although he's not even starting for his USFL
awful.
Team.
He was awful in right? week one.
Oh, right, which is kind of funny to see. What, Josh, what else am I missing for somebody who's not yet been acquainted with the joys of the USFL?
I don't know. Like I said, so the big thing about the Spring League football is obviously getting money, which a lot of the other ones haven't got. But we have $150 million from Fox, who owns the USFL, and they're willing to put that over 3 years. So this is a league that's in progression, so people shouldn't just be jumping off board after week one. 10-game, 10-week season, split up into two divisions, north and south, playing. The only game that won't be played will be the final. That's being played in Canton. Daryl Johnson is the vice president of the football operations. That's Moose. There's some really funny tweaks. Like, there's a 45-man roster and only 39 active guys on game day. So injuries are a big deal. Practices are pretty funny because they consist of basically starters versus starters. So everybody's trying to adapt to what is ultimately another spring league. Rostered, active roster players make about $4,500 per week. And one of the big thing is they're looking for players who were on practice squads, not players who have been out of football for 3 or 4 years and decided, let's give it a shot. So there's still guys who are trying to find their way back onto NFL practice squads.
What's the deal with this Davion Smith situation, who I guess got cut kind of because of a chicken salad sandwich?
Did you see the video? The video's sad. So it's just like him and like four coaches, and it's like he's in, I don't know, in kindergarten detention. And they're saying, well, why didn't you want the chicken salad? He's like, well, I don't eat chicken salad. I wanted pizza. And then one of the coaches came in with pizza. He's like, can I have a slice of your pizza? And he's like, no. And then apparently he wasn't very nice to him, I guess. He said he was very respectful to him. But anyway, he was let go for not digging the chicken salad. So the funny thing was, is that head coach, that's in Pittsburgh, Kirby Wilson is the head coach for Pittsburgh. He has no previous coaching experience, but he was a running back coach in the NFL for 23 seasons. So you'd think if anyone could give him some credit, it would be him. But he's on his way out. And the irony now is that Kirby was awful in his head coaching debut. The worst offense in week one, 3.00 yards per play. He ran the ball three times while trailing at third or five or longer. So Kirby's got a long way to go himself.
I felt really bad for that kid, man. I guess, you know, he was accused of being disrespectful to this, I guess, hotel staffer.
Well, what's that? Who was the staff. Sorry, yeah, it was a staff, correct. Yeah,
I believe that to be the case. And yeah, just really weird and kind of, you know, maybe not entirely surprising from one of these spring football leagues. Speaking of, by the way, Josh, we've had a ton of pro gamblers come on this pod and recommend that more casual gamblers like myself find an edge by going kind of deep on somewhat obscure leagues. For instance, Korean baseball, Chinese basketball, Patriot League, college ball, whatever. Do you think USFL is a decent opportunity for a casual gambler to really learn a lot about it and develop an edge that way? Because these lines are less picked over, certainly, than, let's say, the NFL.
Oh, absolutely. These lines are very inefficient as opposed to you going in on Sunday afternoon and taking the Raiders at 3.5 on a line that's been sitting there all week. The idea of betting on other lesser leagues is more, if people think it's more of a sign of degeneracy, but the fact is there's better edges to be had with these leagues. Like I said, the efficiency versus inefficiency line is very prevalent here in the USFL, especially after week one, where we now have data, we now have information, we now can figure out where we are. And this is just also a great league just to practice your handicapping skills in general. We know about as much as the books do in terms of players and talent, and there are discrepancies to be had in these numbers, which, like we said, doesn't happen in the NFL, especially later in the week. These lines aren't as efficient. And now, with a week of data in our graphs, we have great information for this week's lines, and the league's information is key, and it's out there if you dig into it.
All right, let's go with that. You were nice enough to send me a list of some of your observations from week one of the USFL. I'm going to mention several of them that I thought might be, you know, especially good for people who are looking to gamble on week two and beyond, and then you can just kind of take it anywhere you want to go. First up, you mentioned that these teams are having some trouble, at least so far, putting points on the board, and you wrote the totals should not be above 42. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, 42 is the key number in total here, 21-21 aside. We saw the one game go over this mark, the opening game, which was a game I was actually on the under, and that was more of a test to the Birmingham offense got hot late. They were terrible for three quarters, but you could see these both defenses kind of wearing down in the fourth quarter, especially against the run, and teams were picking up five-yard chunks. And then obviously that opens up for bigger plays in the passing game. But you just saw it, I don't know, these teams fall apart down in the fourth quarter. And I would assume later on in the season that these conditioning issues wouldn't be a problem. But 42 is the number we see in week two lines that the game between Michigan, I believe, and New Jersey, that's at 42.5. And I'd peg that at 42 right on. So that number's not off. But with some of the other offenses, 40, these should be in the 30s, absolutely.
Okay, so you're leaning towards under in general at this point in the season with USFL teams.
I would love to bet overs. Like, who doesn't want it? But if you watched it yourself, you know there's just not enough skill. One penalty on offense puts you behind the sticks, and it's almost insurmountable, especially when teams are third and long.
You mentioned that there are just 39 active roster spots, and that can lead to some defenses getting gassed in the fourth. Is there a way that you would use that to your advantage as a bettor?
I was looking into that. I looked in some, there's not a lot of niche markets to bet on. I believe the second game that hit on Saturday, I hit the fourth quarter to be the highest scoring quarter. And it just turned out that teams just kind of fell on their faces in needs to score points. And then what we really saw with teams that did have leads, I mean, the play calling just got so conservative. Teams were kicking on their own 49-yard line, punting on their own 49-yard line. It just doesn't – there's not a lot of signs pointing to over 42. And Jordan Tamau, that I thought would be the savior in his first drive, he looked amazing. And then he just kind of fell flat too. And a lot of that had to do with protection issues, as some of these offensive lines and some of these offensive systems have only had 2.5 weeks to put their systems together.
You know, in the NFL, we as fans complain all the time about the kickers. Like, are you kidding me? You can't find 30, 32, whatever it is, that 30 of these guys who can kick a 40-yard field goal. You know, watch the USFL for a little while. It puts that whole kicking argument in perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah, 4 for 12. The long was 48. But the second longest was like 20 or 38. Guys were missing chip shots. One team has a kicker who's never played football in his entire life and was a soccer player coming out of Notre Dame who used to take the penalty kicks. So, I mean, there's so many points left on the board. You're not getting these 3 points, and teams' offenses just aren't strong enough to go for it and continually move the sticks on 3rd and 3, even 3rd and 4.
You mentioned that the New Jersey Generals were able to put up 400 yards of offense last week. This week, they're playing Jeff Fisher and Michigan. What do you think? Does that make New Jersey? First of all, are they dogs this week? Because I know we talked about how they likely would be. I meant to check it.
Yeah, line opened up. I expected Michigan just because they had first overall pick, Jeff Fisher. They might be 1.5-point favorites, and it could bounce around. But it looks like New Jersey is a 1-point favorite. So basically, we're looking at a pick 'em for that Friday night game.
You like either side on that one?
This one's tough. I wanted New Jersey to play anybody but that Jeff Fisher team. Jeff Fisher's offense kind of got hot, but Shea Patterson, who would be the worst pick ever, they picked him ahead of Jordan Ta'amu, which is insane just because of the Michigan ties. But he muffed 3 shotgun snaps, like just flat out dropped them. Like, and he just had to fall on the ball. He lost one of those, but it goes back, and he's not going to move the sticks going down 2nd and 15. That's for sure. So that offense with some competent play could be a lot better than what they did. I mean, they didn't pull out the win. That's for sure. Saturday afternoon in week 1, but there was a bit of movement. Jeff Fisher did get a lot of movement, jet sweep, fake RPO action. There was a lot of moving parts in that offense, and probably another week will do it good. 42.5. The bookmakers got this one right on the nose. 42.5 is the tough one, and it's a pick 'em. I don't really know where to go. Those are my 2 favorite offenses so far, but there's some hidden gems. That Pittsburgh offense is awful, and that total should be 35, but I think it's at 38, 39. So I think I like the under on all other 3 games.
On all 3 other ones. Okay. Any other good ones you want to hit before we move on? Any angles that listeners should know about heading into week 2?
Expecting teams to score late is not necessarily going to happen. If it's 17-0 after 3 quarters, it could very much finish 17-0 at the end of the game. When these offenses who are trying to play catch up, they just don't have the skills to do it.
Okay. So that's a weird one, because the offenses may not have the skill to catch up, even though the defenses are going to be gassed.
And then I know, but then the teams, but they won't be more gassed than they were in week 1, I would think, with conditioning getting picked up. And then on the other side of that, the team leading the offensive play calling has been so conservative that they're not even pushing for it. I mean, they're kicking from the 50-yard line at 4th and 2, up 17-0. So there's just not a whole lot to like offensive wise, play calling wise, kicking wise. I mean, even the field conditions were fine, but the weather in Alabama wasn't so hot this weekend either.
All right, let's have a little fun. I want to play a game of USFL player or sitting member of Congress. Really simple, Josh. I know you watched every single USFL.
Yeah, let me preface this.
Go ahead.
I was on the mend on the weekend. I got to watch every snap uninterrupted with money on the line, and I'm going to fail this hardcore.
Go ahead. All right, really simple, man. I'm going to give you a name. You tell me, USFL player or sitting member of Congress. You ready for this?
Yeah, let's roll.
All right, here we go. Number 1, Brian Scott. Is Brian Scott a USFL player
Brian,
or a member?
Brian Scott is 5'5" of quarterback of the Philadelphia Stars.
Bingo. You nailed it, man. I wanted to start you off with an easy one. I actually think you're going to do better with this than you think. But yeah, Brian Scott is the quarterback for the Philadelphia Stars, number 18, played his college ball at Occidental, went undrafted in 2017, but he threw for 202 yards, 1 touchdown, and 1 pick in a week 1 loss to the New Orleans Breakers. Very good job. Here we go. Number 2.
I'd put him in the top 3. I'd put him in the top 3 QBs in the league right now.
Okay. All right. Very nice. Very nice. Number 2. USFL player or sitting member of Congress, Brandon Aubrey. Brandon Aubrey.
Oh, it sounds like such a good football name, but I'm going to have to go Congress.
He is a kicker for the Birmingham Stallions. How could you miss this? He's number 10. He actually, this is the guy that you were talking about.
This is a Notre Dame place kicker.
Exactly. Exactly, yeah. Which is why I wanted to include him. You already mentioned who he was. Yeah, he played for Notre Dame, but he did not play football. He played soccer. He was drafted by the MLS team in Toronto. I think it's Toronto FC. I could be wrong about that. And as far as I can tell, he's never played a snap of football before.
Yep.
Number 3.
There's the USFL personified, absolutely.
Okay, number 3. We're going to do 5 of these, by the way. Number 3. Dutch Ruppersberger.
The old D-man. That sounds like a 70-year-old man of Congress.
Nailed it. Democrat out of Maryland. He's been the U.S. Representative for Maryland's 2nd District since 2003. Okay, you're on a roll here. Let's go. Number 4, Ronnie Jackson.
Oh, Ronnie Jackson sounds like a backup running back for, I don't know, for the Birmingham Stallion.
Sorry, my man. He is a current Republican congressman out of Texas. He is a former physician to the president for both Obama and Trump. Parts of both of their terms, actually.
Oh, that one stung.
Okay, last one. Number 5, Alonzo Moore.
Alonzo Moore. I'm going to go football player.
Nailed it. Going out with a receiver win. Yes, nice. Really nice. He is a wide receiver for the New Jersey Generals. And I'll tell you what, this was a hard one too, because while he was targeted 3 times in their first game, he was unable to reel in a catch. And he played his college ball for Nebraska, but he graduated 6 years ago in 2016. I don't know what he's been doing since.
Maybe catching balls. I don't know. Hopefully putting up some points. I think I'm on that over. But 42 and a half. I keep thinking about it. I'll be thinking about it all week. Like it seems like such a dumb thing to think about, a USFL Friday night total. But you brought it up about that there are edges in this league. And I think in the USFL, there are some. They'll dry out soon, but in the next couple of weeks, there are some edges to be had.
I'm all in. I'm going to be watching. I'm going to be betting. Like I said, I had a lot of fun with it. Clearly, this is not NFL football, but it's fun. And specifically, it's really fun to bet on. And I'm not betting big money by any stretch of the imagination, but I am enjoying it. I'm into the USFL. I'm a fan, and I was not expecting to be before I watched.
Yeah, Friday night game. We get a Friday night game this week, and then the Saturday game, I believe, starts at 12 o'clock, and then there'll be another one after that. So, I mean, a little parlay if you want, like just enough to keep you in the action. If you don't want to single bet these, you don't have to, obviously, but it is football. The commentary is great. The camera works fantastic. The production's great, and the product will get better week to week. I think
I enjoyed some of those weird camera angles. Like they put some cameras on guys' helmets. They had a drone flying around. They're trying, right? It's different.
But like if there's a place to experiment, it's obviously here. I mean, the drone guy just whizzes his drone like through active players during play.
I know.
It's absolutely bananas. That guy's just sitting there, just thinks he's the cock of the walk, showing off like he's got to be the best drone flyer in sports.
I need somebody to put out some odds on which week one of these players is inevitably going to get hit by the drone, because it's coming.
And you just hear that drone sound all the time too, which is kind of annoying. You're like, oh, it's not the drone. It's all right. But there are some cool aspects of it. I mean, the penalties and stuff like that, like a 15-yard pass interference is 15 yards pass interference. It's a spot call now. So that also hurts the overs. So a bomb, you're not getting bailed out on a 50-yard PI call, defensive PI call. I don't know.
I'll be watching.
What are we expecting from it, obviously?
I'll be watching. I'm going to bet those unders and probably some other weird stuff too. Josh, this was fun. Thanks for coming on, man. Where can listeners find you?
Do a lot of writing over at covers.com. Do all the hockey, NHL stuff, MLB analyst, USFL. I put up my hand for the USFL. Not a lot of people were jumping in front to take that one. You can find me on Twitter at covers_Joshua. Show my degeneracy. I don't know if my Liverpool over 2.5 plus win ticket came in while we were doing this interview, but yeah, I like to get down. I like some action during the course of my day while I'm writing, for sure.
I like it, man. You're gonna hear from me again. We're gonna have you back on if you'll do it. Josh Ingles, covers.com. Thanks again for coming on and schooling us on some USFL.
Anytime, man. Anytime there's an edge to be had, you should be sharing them, that's for sure. Don't be greedy with your edges.
Never. Couldn't. Thanks again.
I appreciate it, Josh. Take care.
There it is, ladies And gents, we'll be back next Wednesday with an episode. I think the pod's going to be really good. We're going to do an NFL draft preview because the NFL draft is next week. You can bet it. I actually think the draft is really fun to bet. And it's just going to be a bunch of good NFL info. Our guest for that one is Shil Kapadia from The Athletic. Shil's amazing. He's incredible. I've been bugging him for months to come on this podcast, and he's been so nice to deal with all my requests, and it's finally working out. And I am absolutely pumped because this is a guy who knows his stuff, and I think it's going to be really good. So please check us out next week with that one. And otherwise, you know the deal. Thanks for rating, subscribing, reviewing. IG at Rambling and Gambling. Email ramblingandgamblingpodcast@gmail.com. Everybody, have a great week.